Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first part of Focus, we will be talking with political columnist and commentator Arianna Huffington. She is nationally syndicated. She's the author of 8 books, among them biographies of Maria Callas and Pablo Picasso. This morning, I'm sure we'll be talking about some of the ideas that she lays out in her most recent, which is titled How to Overthrow the Government. She's someone who, until fairly recently, would have clearly been labeled a conservative and was known for her ties to some of the top conservatives in the country, among them Newt Gingrich. More recently, however, she has become an outspoken critic of both political parties, saying that they are both corrupt and self-serving, and also a very outspoken critic of American politics. And some of these ideas indeed are expressed in this book that's now out in paperback. During the campaign of 96, you might recall, she teamed up with another political commentator from the left, Al Franken, and did political coverage for Comedy Central during the conventions that year, also on election night. She has appeared on all of the major TV talk shows, including Larry King, Nightline, Charlie Rose, Firing Line, The Today Show. She serves on several boards that promote community solutions to social problems, including the Points of Light Foundation, just to name one, where she chairs the Communications Committee and works on the Foundation's Families Volunteering Project. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, your questions are welcome. Anyone's welcome to join the conversation. All we ask, as always, is just for people to try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and get as many people in as possible. But anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if it would be long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-WILL. And then here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Ms. Huffington, hello.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. And thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
I guess myself, I've felt for some time now that to try to describe anyone or almost anyone in just a few words is not very useful and probably doesn't do them much of a service. Having said that, however, could you, in a relatively few words, describe how it is that at this point you describe yourself politically?
Well, my political thinking has definitely evolved, partly because the issues that really concerned me the most, especially those left out of our prosperity, the fact that we are becoming increasingly two nations in America, divided by our access to health, education, and the good times, I found that these issues were not really seriously being addressed by either political party, that both parties were basically making their priorities, the priorities that were those of their big campaign contributors. And it's really sort of my disenchantment with the way our system works that has led to the shift in my political views. So if I was going to give myself a label now, I would call myself a progressive populist, because I really look to the people to bring about fundamental change. I have lost hope that real reform is going to come from Washington.
Hmm. I'm interested in what you think about campaign finance reform and whether now the conversation that's been going on for a couple of weeks in the Senate is going to lead anywhere.
I think that John McCain is one of the few leaders left in our political system. He's passionate about the subject. He has galvanized people around it. As you may remember, during the primary, he got young people to care again about politics because they believed that he could clean up the system. So I have nothing but admiration for what he's doing. At the same time, I'm very pessimistic about this bill actually becoming law. I know it will pass the Senate today, probably. And that makes many people think that, therefore, success is here. But there's a long, bumpy road ahead. It has to pass the House, and Tom DeLay has said over his dead body. Then it has to go to conference and have the Senate and the House versions reconciled. And then it has to be signed by the president. So there are many roadblocks ahead. And I think that the incumbents of both parties who don't want to seek law are basically waiting and biding their time and looking for the next opportunity to stop it.
I don't want to drag you back to the past too much, but I do wonder how your feelings about the issue of campaign finance might have been shaped by your experiences with your former husband as he ran for the Senate in California and at the time, I think, set a record for the amount of money that was spent in a race.
He did. He spent about $30 million, and of course now that seems small compared to what John Corzine spent, which is about $65 million in New Jersey, which is tiny compared to California. But definitely, I saw firsthand during my ex-husband's campaign the influence of money in politics, the way that money buys consultants and pollsters and the professionalization of a political campaign, so that little by little, all issues and all priorities take second place to what consultants and pollsters think are the issues to appeal to swing voters. And we've seen that very starkly in the last election when both Bush and Gore effectively campaigned on minor issues like the increases in prescription drug prices, which is important, but it's not the major crisis facing this country compared to education and health care and the fact that we now have 2 million people in jail and the failure of our drug laws. A lot of these major issues were not addressed because consultants and pollsters were claiming that they would not appeal to swing voters.
Do you favor or would you favor public financing of campaigns?
Yes, absolutely. I think that right now we are basically ending up with not the best that this country can offer in terms of political leadership. We end up with people who don't mind spending two-thirds of their time begging for money. And I think that if we change our campaign system and if we have some public funding of campaigns, we're going to see a very different kind of person running for office.
Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is syndicated columnist and author Arianna Huffington. She is well known as political commentator. She's the author of a number of books. Her most recent is titled How to Overthrow the Government, which is now available in paperback, published by Regan Books, which is a division of HarperCollins. If you have questions, comments, you want to join in the conversation here, you're certainly welcome to do that. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll free 800-222-9455. I asked you just at the beginning of the program to talk a little bit about where you feel that you are now politically, and I know I've read some of the things I've read. You have said that you thought that it was not so much a matter of transformation as you have evolved in your thinking, and some of the positions that you would take now may not be all that different or all that surprising given what you have thought in the past. And again, having sort of said all that, was there anything specific, anything particular, anything that you could point to that has happened to you or that you have seen over the last couple of years that has pushed you now into the direction that you've taken?
Yes, I would say that 1994, 1995, I worked hard to see if the private sector could step up to the plate in terms of providing the kind of resources that are needed to address the problems of poverty and the discrepancies that I'm talking about in the book. And I discovered the hard way that there was a lot of talk about that, but in fact, most of the money given to charity does not go to the greatest need. It goes to the fashionable museums, and it goes to prestigious educational institutions like Harvard or Stanford, and that, in fact, the needs that remain unaddressed really need the raw power of government appropriations to be seriously addressed. Now, that doesn't mean that we need big Washington-based federal programs. We've learned a lot since the Great Society, and we've seen how small programs, small projects all around the country are every day turning lives around and having a huge impact. So now the model that I'm advocating is identifying those projects and then using government appropriations to bring them to scale, to provide the financial resources that are needed. But the projects themselves, the remarkable people around the country, are the ones providing the leadership for what we need to do.
This brings to mind the kind of program that Mr. Bush has talked about, President Bush has talked about, that is taking government money and providing it to nonprofit organizations, among them religious organizations that are doing social service work. Some people have raised questions about that, getting to the issue of separation of church and state. What do you think about that idea of trying to take more of that money that previously we might have spent on government-run programs and then provide that to nonprofits, to charities who are doing that kind of work?
Well, I'm in favor of Bush's faith-based initiatives. I believe that if you look at what it is that turns lives around, it invariably involves some element of faith, a higher power, since most of troubled lives are troubled because of some behavioral issue, especially addiction or violence. We see that the success rate that a program like Alcoholics Anonymous has, or smaller programs that bring in faith, not any particular religion, but the belief in some higher power. I mean, we've seen that it's very hard to turn lives around without it. And as long as there are secular alternatives for those who don't want to deal with a higher power in any form, then I don't see what the problem is. I mean, what is interesting is the strange bedfellows that have lined up against the faith-based initiative proposal. They range from Pat Robertson to Barry Lynn, who runs the Americans for Separation of Church and State and sees a threat to that separation around every corner.
Well, we have one caller here. I'm expecting we have some other folks who would like to talk with you. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And the caller here is on our toll-free line in Lafayette, Indiana, line number 4. Hello?
Hi, thanks for listening.
Sure.
I have a question to backtrack a little bit regarding the campaign finance reform. Probably one of the biggest things that has come up in the debate is the constitutionality issue and the freedom of speech. And while a lot of people seem to be looking at it on an intellectual basis of things, just say, how can that be freedom of speech, there is court precedent for that sort of thing. And I'm wondering, how can any financing campaign reform be passed with this in the background? And I'll just hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that this is, of course, the main argument that the opponents of campaign finance reform are using against it. But let me just say that the Supreme Court, in the case in Missouri, in the decision actually written by David Souter, made it very clear that the threat to the confidence in our political system at the moment is so great that it should be taken into consideration and really used against the argument that any kind of restrictions on money in politics is unconstitutional.
All right, let's go to Urbana here for someone else. Line number 1. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about the faith-based organizations being accepting the government subsidies. And it's always brought up, and often I hear Alcoholics Anonymous made reference to, and I just wanted to clarify that Alcoholics Anonymous would never accept a government donation. They won't even accept donations from private organizations that want to do funding. It's all grassroots, bottom-up funded. So the members make donations. They put a dollar in the basket, and that's how the whole thing is funded. And to bring up Alcoholics Anonymous as a way to support the idea of faith-based organizations needing government-funded is backwards. And it doesn't address the fact that there's a conflict of interest between religion and state. So I wish you would address that.
I brought up Alcoholics Anonymous not because of the funding issue, but because of the higher power element in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is really what faith-based initiatives are also trying to bring into recovery and to the whole process of turning lives around.
Right, but they do it with specifically without, I mean, they do it so much so that with a higher power, but knowing that that you can only do that because it's got a separation from any other. They don't accept money from churches. They don't accept money from the government, you know. And that's the only way that you can not have the influence of saying a specific God, defining that God, and that's where the conflict comes in.
If there was an attempt to force people to pray to a particular God or accept a particular God, then I would agree with you. But this is absolutely strictly not the case. I mean, the faith-based initiatives would fund Muslim groups and Christian groups and Jewish groups and Hare Krishna, and I think that is key.
But even if they fund those, then the money that is used for those organizations could be used to try to influence people to pray to their specific God, whichever specific God it is. That money would definitely be used for that. And even if it, you say the program isn't, other money is going to be diverted from that church so that they don't have to, you know, pay whatever to pay their mortgages.
Well, there's no question that they're going to be abusive. But right now we have so many casualties in our country, so many people suffering, needing help, and so many good programs that are using a faith-based approach that need more funding, that I think instead of saying let's throw the baby out with the bathwater, let's say let's be very vigilant, let's be very clear that any abuses will be dealt with very categorically, and let's not pretend that we don't know what works in turning lives around, because we do.
Well, it just, I think it's so contrary that Bush would say that he wants faith-based organizations, but then he cut off the funding for any organizations that has abortions performed.
Well, I mean, I agree with you that there is a lot of mistrust because of Bush's other policies. But if you go back to Al Gore's proposal during the campaign, he had an identical proposal on faith-based initiatives. So this is not just particular to George Bush. It's just that because it's coming from George Bush and because of George Bush's ties to the religious right, there is more skepticism. And I understand that. I mean, I don't blame you for being skeptical. All I'm saying is that I'm more interested in looking at how this can be implemented successfully. I have a lot of respect for John DiUlio, who's been appointed to run faith-based initiatives, and I think it's definitely something that we need to try.
Aren't we already trying it? I mean, what is the difference between what George Bush is proposing and what's happening now? There's been faith-based initiative efforts. I mean, there currently aren't there?
Right now, there has to be a separate entity to receive government funding, like Catholic Charities, for example, has set up a separate entity that can receive government funding. But a lot of the small groups around the country that cannot hire fancy lawyers to turn them into 501c3, as a result, cannot benefit.
Well, it doesn't take a fancy lawyer to become a 501c3. I mean,
it takes a lot of money and time.
It takes some.
I've done it.
It takes some, but it helps with its separation. So how could it be monitored if you're not a not for profit? I mean, I don't know.
Monitored because these are going to be the regulations, and these will be the conditions under which the group would be accepting the money.
I need to kind of jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, but I'm getting close to the midpoint here, and I want to try to get some other folks into the program and also introduce again our guest for this part of Focus. We're talking with political columnist and author Arianna Huffington. She is nationally syndicated. She's the author of 8 books, as I mentioned, among them biographies of Maria Callas and Pablo Picasso. Her latest is titled How to Overthrow the Government, which is her criticism of American politics as is. You no doubt know her from her many appearances on some of the most high-profile television talk programs. She's talking with us this morning by telephone. Your questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. At the time that the Republicans took over control of the House, of the Congress, Mr. Gingrich became Speaker. I think a number of the people who came to Washington came with a distinctly hostile attitude toward the federal government. And in fact, people talked about their interest in being in Congress, going to Washington, dismantling the government as much as they possibly could, and then going home after a few years. I wonder now, you know, again, given the fact that at one point I would have thought that you would have been in harmony with that kind of attitude, if you could talk a little bit more about what you see as the role, the appropriate role, particularly when it comes to dealing with social matters, the appropriate role for the federal government.
Well, as I say in the book, because I trace actually what happened in 94 and the so-called Gingrich Revolution, it was very deceptive for many of us, because when he gave his first speech as Speaker, for example, he spoke about overcoming poverty being a higher priority than balancing the budget. So his rhetoric was very different than his actions. And it was, in fact, gradually, as I and many others observed his actions, that it was clear that his priority was really to balance the budget and restrict government, as you said. Now, for me, the question of the role of government is purely a question of effectiveness. What is the most effective way to solve problems? And that's why I mentioned these projects all around the country that are doing an incredible job. I'm involved with quite a few of them in turning lives around. And so the most effective use of government here would be to provide the financial resources to bring them to scale, because these groups already have the know-how and the imagination and the creativity to solve problems. They just don't have adequate resources.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana. It's line number one. Hello?
Yeah, hi. I was going to say I enjoyed the shadow convention. I thought that was a lot of fun.
Did you come to Los Angeles or Philadelphia?
Oh, no. I mean,
Watched it on C-SPAN.
You watched it, yeah.
Yeah, and as much as I could catch of it. But I wanted to ask you about one of the speakers there. I don't know if you're familiar with everybody that spoke there, but I believe the guy's name was Tom Campbell.
Yes.
And he was from California.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this really emotional and rousing speech against our drug policies.
Yes, absolutely. Tom Campbell was a member of Congress from California who ran against Dianne Feinstein and lost. And Campbell was really a pioneer in drug reform. And it's one of the confusing aspects of our political system that two of the greatest pioneers on drug policy reform, Tom Campbell and Governor Gary Johnson of New Mexico, are Republicans. This is one of the areas that I have a whole chapter about in the book, where there is really no new thinking coming out of the political establishment in Washington. And so Tom Campbell definitely stood out in advocating an end to mandatory minimums, an end to the differential between crack and powder cocaine, basically an end to the emphasis on incarceration rather than treatment. And indeed, there was a proposition, Prop 36, that passed in California that is putting the emphasis on treatment over incarceration.
Mm. Well, I thought I'd ask you, what is the Republican Party doing with this fellow? Is he?
Well, he's gone back to teaching in California, but I did definitely hope that he will be back in politics. And he's a good friend, and I'll certainly tell him that you've noticed him.
Okay. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks.
Again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. I think some people have been talking about President Bush now in his first weeks in office and have confessed some amazement that he's done well, or at least they have talked about it in that terms. And I suppose other people would say, well, he actually hasn't done much of anything, but he hasn't made any major mistakes. What can you say, do you think, about the first weeks and months of the Bush administration and what that means for now really the term of his presidency?
Well, I wouldn't say he hasn't made any major mistakes. I consider what he did with the environment, the reversal of his pledge to regulate carbon dioxide, for example, a major mistake, in terms of trust in him and his promises, a mistake in terms of policy, a mistake in terms of humiliating his new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christine Todd Whitman, who had spent the last month promoting this policy here and abroad. So I think his environmental record so far is a disaster and is galvanizing people against him. Also, the fact that he's been monomaniacal about this tax cut, as though it's the solution to all ills, and has not taken a position on a major issue like campaign finance reform. I know he's determined to set his own agenda, but there are things happening in the country, and he needs to respond to them with more than a wait-and-see attitude, campaign finance reform being one of them.
I think, too, that some people have looked at his sort of official backing away from the Kyoto Accord, the continued determination of Republicans, and I don't know how you feel about this, but continued determination of him and other Republicans to build an anti-missile defense, a seeming lack of engagement and involvement in international affairs, all of that taken together as an indication that, number one, that the United States doesn't really care much about what happens outside of its borders, and number two, that he is not going to be inclined to be involved overseas as other administrations have, and that again, this reflects a kind of isolationist policy that says we're the United States, we don't care what goes on elsewhere, and if you don't like our policy, tough. Is that the way that you see it?
Well, definitely when it comes to the missile defense, I think it's just an old-fashioned policy that hasn't been updated. When it comes to the Kyoto Agreement, it's again putting the business interests above the environment, our air and water. When it comes to our involvement in armed conflict elsewhere, I think that the Clinton, the so-called Clinton Doctrine, was a disaster. I think what we did in Kosovo clearly did not work. I mean, we have major conflict going on at the moment. It's not on our front pages anymore, but it was not the way we basically destroyed the infrastructure of Yugoslavia. We were responsible for the displacement of a lot of people from Kosovo. We clearly could have predicted what would have happened with extremist Albanians. So that's just one case where I think the United States government's interventionist policy did not work. There are many other chickens that are coming home to roost, like China, when we put trade above all other considerations. And now we're seeing that we really did not address the major problems that dealing with the totalitarian regime present.
Well, what do you think that it is that that underpins or informs the foreign policy of the Bush White House?
I think that, first of all, I have tremendous respect for Colin Powell. So the question is, how much influence is he going to have compared to Rumsfeld and some of the hardliners like Cheney in the administration who are looking at you know, the old Star Wars, Cold War paradigm? I mean, I think we'll know more when we see what they do with Yugoslavia. I think it would be terrible if they don't provide the aid that was promised to Yugoslavia because they're refusing to hand over Milosevic to the international court. I mean, Yugoslavia desperately needs aid. It has a democratic government. We are responsible for its destruction and the huge environmental calamity that our bombing brought about. So the least we can do is show that we're willing to help now. So that would be a major test for the administration.
Going back to the last presidential election, it was clear that a lot of Americans continue to be disengaged from politics. It was clear that a lot of people said they felt they were disappointed by the choices that they had, not only, I think, among the major party candidates, but alternative candidates. I think some people indeed were energized by Ralph Nader. I know there are a lot of people in this community that were. But that when you looked at the people who voted, there seemed to be an almost disinclination to go strongly in either direction, the feeling that one candidate was as good as another. And so the outcome was fairly closely, among those people who bothered to vote, the outcome was fairly closely divided. Now, as I start looking ahead to the next time around, and probably it will get going too soon for everybody, do you think that, in fact, that we'll see essentially the same kind of process over again, the same kind of election, the same kind of disengagement, the same kind of a divided country that we did in 2000?
Well, unfortunately, I believe that unless we actually have some different kind of leaders running, different policies that will engender more confidence in the system. Yes, unfortunately, I'm very pessimistic about participation. I think it is a major problem that's not being addressed by either candidate, that wasn't being addressed by the candidate in the presidential race, and isn't seriously addressed by either party. But here we are, we have half the eligible voters not voting in the last election. And that is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Did you, at some point in the last election, either in the run-up to it or at the point where we had a number of candidates that were there on the ballot, did you endorse a particular candidate,
or no.
So you were not speaking in favor of anybody in particular?
No, I never did. I find that as a columnist, I need to maintain my neutrality. I mean, I take strong stands in favor or against particular positions by candidates. But the minute you endorse one of them, what if they turn around and do something you object to, your hands are tied. So, no, I'm not in the endorsement business.
Did you vote for someone?
I voted for none of the above.
Ah.
I did vote, but I really was not willing to vote for either Gore or Bush. I thought it was a dreadful indictment on our system that out of 250 million people, we ended up with George Bush and Al Gore as the best we could do.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We have someone in Crystal Lake next in line. Line number four. Hello.
It isn't just apathy when it comes to elections. For instance, in Florida, the police blocked the voting booths off from the black area, which was more the poor area, and the richer areas had optical scanners to be sure they didn't vote for, to be sure their vote was correct. That is not more than one vote or something like that.
I completely agree with the caller. I think this is a major problem that we encountered during the election.
And then the census taking in California, purposely it was done so that the Hispanic areas could not get representation. They excluded five districts from the Hispanics, so they got five more seats in Congress for the Republicans. I do think also on this, you say that the Americans United for Separation of Church and State see something wrong in every corner. Well, that's because the Christian Coalition, so-called, which is really a political group, puts up these issues. For instance, they illegally distributed voting guides to churches, and the Americans for Separation of Church and State sent out letters to say that it was illegal to distribute political biased literature in churches. And also, you have to keep this here faith-based food distribution or food pantries from the Christian Coalition, they're really a political group. They're not really Christian. For instance, in a Baptist home, the money for children there went to sectarian purposes, and the Christian Coalition is not really involved in actually helping people. They don't protest lack of health care for children or older people, for that matter, either. They did involve themselves in the Contra War in Nicaragua, which was Reagan's war to undermine the duly elected governments there. also Americans United for Church find that public hospitals that merge with Catholics have to abide by the Catholic rules. So I do believe in separation of church and state. Face money should go. It shouldn't be face money. It should be really just unattached money. For instance, Gingrich got money for his Bob Jones University, which Bush espoused, and he got money. Well, he later had to pay a fine, but they maneuver the money not for religious purposes, but for sectarian.
You raise a number of good points. Let's get some response here from Ms. Huffington.
Well, first of all, clearly the whole issue of faith-based initiatives is very controversial, and I recognize that it brings about an enormous amount of concern. I wrote about it at length, and anybody who wants to go to my website, overthrowthegov.com, can read why I believe that without in any way interfering with the separation of church and state, we can really support the original task of churches and mosques and all spiritual institutions, which is to take care of the least among us, as the Bible puts it. And I agree with the caller that the Creative Coalition has become really a political tool, and sorry, not the Creative Coalition, the Christian Coalition. And there's no question that I would much rather see Pat Robertson's group deliver soup and food than delivering voter guides in churches.
Other questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and we are talking with Arianna Huffington. She has been named one of Washington's most influential commentators by both Newsweek and People. She has a syndicated column that appears twice weekly in newspapers around the country. She's the author of several books. She's also a contributing writer to Talk magazine. Her most recent book, if you're interested in reading some of her ideas about American politics, is titled How to Overthrow the Government, which is now available in a paperback edition with some new material dealing with the election of 2000, published by HarperCollins, out there in the bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. Also, if you have internet access, as she mentioned, there's the website overthrowthegovernment.com. Also, she has one that's Arianna Online. So if you just put her name into your web browser, you can find that. And that also has a number of her columns there if you're interested in reading her thoughts on various political subjects. And questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Way back at the beginning of the program, I mentioned your collaboration with Al Franken at the political conventions, and I'm interested in how your friendship with him developed. I guess one wouldn't be surprised that someone like you would become friends with someone who also was a political commentator, but it might seem a little unlikely given the fact that his commentary is satire and it comes from the left side of the political spectrum. What is it about him and guys like him that you find attractive?
Well, actually, first of all, let me just say that right now, when Al and I do a lot of speaking together, and he's the more establishment guy now, and I'm the more radical one, because he, for example, during the election supported Al Gore and went around and campaigned for him, and I believe that both candidates were so flawed that we needed to overthrow the system, as I say in the book. But beyond that, I am a great proponent of the power of satire to change politics and to change our awareness of reality. So wherever we can get satire and wherever we can use it as a tool to really expose the hypocrisy of the current system, I think it's great, and that's what I like so much about what Al does. And what I try to do in my column in a different way, to use satire, and I try to do it in the book to expose what's happening.
Has knowing him and becoming friends and spending time with him and talking with him and making appearances with him had some impact on your, I'm not thinking so much of your political thinking, but in the way you write, in the way you argue points, in the kind of person that you are in a public way?
Definitely, definitely. It had an influence on my political thinking, too, because I remember when I first became friends with him, he was writing a book on Rush Limbaugh. You know, Rush Limbaugh is a fat old, whatever.
Big fat idiot, I believe. I'm just quoting the title of the book, of course, not expressing personal opinion.
Well, it definitely made Rush Limbaugh lose weight, right? So in the course of that book, you know, he would show me things he had found out or things that Limbaugh had said, which were just, I can express opinion, which was so destructive that it made me look again at that whole emphasis on sort of caricaturing the opposition. Even Chelsea Clinton was not immune from it.
Hmm. Well, how when you're in a very public role as a political commentator, the way that you are, or that Al Franken is, or Rush Limbaugh are, there are a lot of different people who do this and who do this for a living. How does one manage to detach one's ego from the desire to actually have some positive impact and not just put yourself on display, but actually put some ideas at least on display?
Well, I think that I haven't really seen that as a problem, because my columns and my books are very much driven by my sort of outrage at what's happening in our system. And the fact that it's me saying it is sort of largely irrelevant. I think it's really how can we bring the maximum amount of attention on the crisis that remain unattended in our country. And if we can use satire to do that, if we can use exaggeration, but keeping all the facts accurate, but using exaggeration in the sense of where are we going if the current trends continue. I say that in the book. I have a section where I look ahead at what could happen if the current rates of disengagement continue. And I exaggerate by saying that 1,000 years from now, there will be one voter left in America that I call Bob Gonzalez from Jacksonville, Florida. And both parties are going to be running multi-trillion-dollar campaigns for his vote. And George Bush the 20th would run on the slogan, vote for George Bush the 20th, he'll do what's good for Bob. Now, that's clearly a dramatization of what's already happening, but sometimes doing something like that catches people's attention and focuses us on what's not being addressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, one might well say that you would think that what's important is not so much who you are, but what you're saying. But at the same time, if you weren't who you were, you wouldn't have the platform that you do. I mean, you are, after all, Arianne Huffington. You're a media personality in addition to being a... You're not just another political commentator.
I prefer to think of myself as a crusading journalist. I believe that journalists have to be objective, but also can be passionate around issues. And, of course, we saw that most powerfully during the civil rights struggle, when journalists were objective, but they were not neutral as to which side they were on. Mm. And I think whenever I see a journalist who takes on a subject and stays with it, and keeps after it. I mean, I have a lot of admiration for that.
We have a couple of people here. We'll try to take at least one more in Chicago, line 4. Hello?
Yes, satire is a universally recognized form of entertainment. Unfortunately, while it's allowed in many parts of the world, including even in dictatorships, it's treated very lightly as entertainment, and it doesn't really get to the heart of the seriousness of some of the issues. They more or less make a jest of the ego or character or misguided escapades of the person they're satirizing. I certainly appreciate all the things you've been saying and look forward to reading your book. And I think the matter of substance has to be dealt with more sincerely and with greater strength, although I appreciate the good humor and satire.
Well, I agree with you. And in my book, you'll see that I make a distinction between, say, late-night comedy and real biting political satire, the great champions being like Jonathan Swift and Mark Twain. And also, let me just say that if any of your listeners want to receive my column twice a week, if you just send me an email to ariana@overthrowthegov.com, I'll add you to the list in case there isn't a paper near you that's running the column.
Okay, let's see if we can get one more, at least here in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I had two comments about people not showing up at the polls. First, it's perfectly possible that they're actually voting. In a sense, they're abstaining from voting, and that's just where they stand. And they don't want to pick a candidate, and so the fact that they don't show up at the polls is, in a sense, a vote. The second thing is, perhaps we want the people who are most informed to vote, and so people who really care, who are most informed, engage in the issues, show up at the polls, and others that don't. And, you know, so why is that bad?
Well, it's definitely a statement that don't vote, and they've said in many surveys that they don't vote. 64% in the latest Michigan University survey said they don't vote or they don't participate because they don't trust the system. They believe that the system is run for the benefit of special interests and not for the benefit of the average citizen. And that's really at the heart of what I'm trying to say in the book.
I think that we're about at the point that we're going to have to start. Stop. We've almost exhausted our time.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoy doing your show, and thank you for what you're doing.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time, too. And again, for people who are interested, the book we mentioned, Ms. Huffington's most current book, How to Overthrow the Government, is out now. It's in paper, published by HarperCollins. And there are a couple of websites that you can use to get at some of her writing, including the one that we've mentioned, which is www.overthrowthegov.com. You can go there. And again, Ms. Huffington, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.